We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest today is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 17th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
We are talking today about the opera Salome by Richard Strauss, and we are with Desiree Mays. And Desiree, this is a seriously messed up set of characters.
It is. It's a dysfunctional family, right?
To say the least. It makes dysfunctional families look fine.
It does, yeah. And it's biblical. You know, this is not that something that's dreamed up. You can't blame opera for this particular plot. It comes straight out of the Bible. That's where it started. And typically, of course, the productions of Salome that people know and hopefully love are based in biblical times in Judea. We are not doing that this time at the Santa Fe Opera.
We're doing something around the time that the opera was written, more or less.
Yeah. I think of it as there being two Salomes. There's the Salome of Judea, who comes straight from the Bible, the historical Salome. And then there's the Salome of the early 20th century, who is the Salome that is dreamed up, this image of symbolism and decadence, if you like, by Oscar Wilde. For starters, because he wrote the play. He wrote the play Salome, and actually sadly never got to see it played because he was imprisoned at the time that the piece premiered. But this was a meaningful piece for him, and it was a powerful piece, which Richard Strauss then saw a play in French. It was actually written in French by Wilde in Paris, and realized the musical potential of this extraordinary story. And from my point of view, and I think many people believe that the magic, the power of this piece is in the music. All the turbulence of what the characters are feeling is actually in the music. Strauss himself said he didn't want a wildly extrovert Salome, no striptease for the seven veils. He wanted her performance to be very withheld, almost as if she was on a prayer mat, which is a very amazing and very relevant image today.
A prayer mat?
A prayer mat, yes. So she's granting Herod his wish, and we're talking about the Middle East here too. So that's in the early version, but in the more contemporary version, the second coming of Salome, as I call it, it comes from Oscar Wilde, from Richard Strauss. This is his first really big, successful opera. He had written two operas before, Guntram and Feuersnot. Neither had been very successful. They were based on sort of medieval themes, and he was much influenced as a young composer by Richard Wagner, and that comes through those pieces. But this was his first big, major hit, and it was an extraordinary departure from what he had done before. It's really written as one long symphonic tone poem, and one critic said it's a tone poem with added voices. It's also in one act. It's a very intense 90-minute piece, so it goes straight through. So now you have two of the major players, if you like, from the earliest 20th century. There is Oscar Wilde, who wrote the play, Richard Strauss, who composed the opera, and in this production, Freud. Freud is the third person who plays a major role, or his thinking. This is a psychoanalytical version of Salome, which I found intriguing when I first heard about that. I thought, well, that's different. You know, for a start, we're not going to get all those lovely biblical costumes and flowing robes and the Judean desert. No, it's set in the early 1900s, at the time at which it was written. So, thinking about that, let's go into the piece and go through the story anyway, because the story works regardless of whether it's then or now.
Let me ask you, is this, as far as you know, the first time that the opera has been set at the time that the composer, Richard Strauss, wrote
I'm
it?
Not sure, but I think it probably is. I think it's certainly the first time that it's been based on a Freudian interpretation. And I think we have our director to thank for that, Daniel Slater, who gave us Wozzeck. And for people who saw his version of Wozzeck, it was very internalized, intense, introspective, psychoanalytical look at the character of Wozzeck, who is a very put upon soldier. Here he's doing the same thing with Sanare. Now, how do you show that on stage? That was my big question, because so much of this is internalized. How do you express this repression on stage? That's what he's doing with this piece. So let's talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so in order to understand what's going on here with repression and what I call messed upness,
yes,
let's talk about the actual story, because it's a doozy.
It is. It's an amazing story, straight out of the Bible. So the opening is, we're dropped right into the opening. There is a very, very quick run-up on the clarinet, only long enough for the curtain to rise. So you get this little run-up in the music, and we'll hear this as the curtain rises. The music in this piece sort of kaleidoscopes the harmonies. It's unsettling. It's strange music. There's no overture. We are instantly, when we see the stage bathed in a sort of an orchestral light, it's moonlight. And for the symbolist writers of the 20th century, moonlight and all that it implied with its ethereal metaphysical components is what's in this opera. So let's hear the opening here of the opera, and you'll hear the soldier Naraboth sing of how beautiful the Princess Salome looks tonight. So the setting in this story is that Herod is throwing a party. Herod with Herodias, his wife, at his side, and Salome is the daughter of Herodias and Philip. Philip is the brother of Herod. Herodias had Philip imprisoned for many years because she felt she could get further ahead and wield more power if she was married to Herod. So here already we have this strange incestuous relationship. He's her brother in law and was actually her uncle. But Herodias is the mother of Salome, and now we get to meet John the Baptist. John, in the original story, of course, John the Baptist, he's called Yohanan in the opera, and in this production he is a religious zealot who has been imprisoned. He is held in a cistern that's typically below the stage because he is crying out against Herodias as a daughter of iniquity, and he's crying out to the world how evil this woman is.
Well, and he's speaking out and saying, lady, you had your own husband imprisoned so that you could marry your husband's brother because you wanted a social climb faster.
Yeah, he says terrible things about her. So Herodias really has it in for this man. She wants him dead. Herod, on the other hand, is a little superstitious. He hears about the miracles that Jesus is performing, and John the Baptist, remember, came just before Jesus, and he's reporting. He's saying there is one who will save you. At one point, he tells Salome, go find Jesus. He's at the Sea of Galilee. He will forgive your sins. But meantime, he's railing against Herodias. She's furious. Herod is superstitious. He doesn't want to kill the prophet. He also has a political situation going on here because there are many different religions surrounding him and their leaders, and he wants to pacify them and stay in everyone's good book. So in this production, the opera opens with a banquet that Herod is throwing for the leaders of the community or the generals of the 20th century. They all come resplendent with ribbons and awards. But so it's not back in the biblical times. There's some crisis going on. They've come together to discuss. Salome is bored. She's under 20. She's innocent. She's come to this corrupt court, but she's surrounded by evil, literally. She's bored with the dinner and the talk of these generals. She goes out on the balcony where this young soldier, Naraboth, is in love with her and describes how beautiful she is. Then the voice of Yohanan is heard from the cistern, and she hears the voice and she says, who is that? I want to see him. And Naraboth says, I cannot. It's forbidden. I may not let him out. And she insists, I am the daughter of the king. I am the princess of Judea. I want to see him. I insist. She finally wears him down, and he allows her to see Yohanan. And we have this amazing scene then of the confrontation of Yohanan, who has been cooped up in this fetid cell for some time, a wild, more animal than man, and raving about Herodias and the terrible things that are going on. And the innocent Salome, who is confronted by this extraordinary apparition and finds herself turned on, I suppose, by this apparition. She's fascinated by him.
So she falls in love with the wild man, so to speak.
Well, it's not exactly falling in love. She thinks she's falling in love. It's
right,
a sexual obsession.
Infatuated, whatever.
Yeah, it is. She's absolutely drawn to him. So she meets with him and she tells him how beautiful he is. She tells how beautiful his skin is, his hair, his lips. She wants to kiss his lips. And these lines come, Mary Charlotte, originally from the Solomon's Song of Songs. That's where Oscar Wilde took those lines. He's talking about Judea and the beauty of Judea. So she describes Yohanan in these terms when she, in this very first aria where she sings to him. Let me just give you a sense, because I'm going to play you a little of this, as to what she actually says. He is saying from the cistern, after me will come another mightier than I. I am not worthy so much as to loosen the latchet of his shoes. When he cometh, the solitary places will be glad. So this is straight from the biblical version. Let's maybe hear that bit first, the voice of Yohanan that she hears in the cistern.
So that is John the Baptist, also known as Yohanan, singing from the cistern where he's imprisoned.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And when Salome finally talks Naboth into letting her go down to see him, she sings, I am amorous of thy body. Thy body is white like the lilies of the field that the mower has never mowed. Thy body is white like the snows that lie on the mountains of Judea. The roses in the gardens of the Queen of Arabia are not so white as thy body. And then he rejects her back, daughter of Babylon. By woman came evil into this world. Speak not to me. I will not listen to thee. I listen but to the voice of the Lord. And she says, thy body then is hideous. It's like a body of a leper, plastered wall where vipers have crawled, like a plastered wall where the scorpions have made their nest. It is like the whitened sepulchre full of loathsome things. So she turns on him. She's a teenager and she's not getting her way. And this is a princess who is used to getting her way. So let's hear a little of that interaction where she approaches him. She wants to touch him and he rejects her. He actually curses her. This is another opera with a great curse. Du bist verflucht, you are cursed. And she's petulant, she's angry, she turns on him, your body is hideous. And she goes through this ritual a few times. Let's hear a little of that.
Yeah. das Weib kam das Schwimmen in die Welt. Sprich nicht zu mir, ich will dich nicht anhören. Ich höre nur auf die Stimme des Herrn, meines Gottes.
Very, very dramatic.
Yeah, it is. It's a dramatic piece. And this is a marvelous recording. The conductor is Christoph von Dohnányi. Catherine Malfitano sings Salome, and Bryn Terfel sings Johanahan on this recording, all of the excerpts that I'm playing today.
And I think it's really interesting, and you write about this in Opera Unveiled, that the composer had some very clear ideas of what kind of person and what kind of voice he wanted playing Salome.
Yeah, he did. He wanted a voice that was, he described as transparent, with a real girlish clarity of tone and a rather unemotional, disengaged quality. That was the sort of voice he would have liked. Though he's asking a lot, because any Straussian soprano has to be able to sing over a vast orchestra, which automatically rules out most of the singers with a very gentle, soft type of sound. He loved the sound of Elisabeth Schumann. She managed with her very sweet and fine voice to ride over that big orchestra. What he got was something different. He got a woman called Frau Wittig, who was a healthy, robust woman. She was totally unsuited to the role.
Who sang the premiere.
Who sang at the premiere, yes. And you know what they used to do, Mary Charlotte? And when I first saw this opera in Dublin as a child, talk about stretching belief. They'd have this wonderful singer who was generally a large lady singing Salome, and then come to the dance of the Seven Veils, which she clearly couldn't handle. So what would happen was the singer would disappear behind a rock and a dancer would come out and do the Seven Veils.
And of course you were a dancer, you were, yeah, an opera dancer professionally. Did,
yeah,
you?
I never did the Seven Veils. No, I didn't. But that was ridiculous. And nowadays the singers will take it on. And with careful choreography, it's very effective. And the way it's going to be done here is not going to be a dance. And lest I disappoint everyone, they should know now rather than later, there will not be several veils shed in this production. We're doing it quite another way, and we'll get to that. But Strauss made the point. He said, he gave clear instructions. He said, the acting of the singers, in contrast to the excessive turmoil of the music, should be limited to the utmost simplicity. So that's something one hopes that directors will listen to, because the action in this is in the orchestra. Listen to. So I'd like to play you a little excerpt here, that the point at which Johanahan, after this interaction with Salome, the first one, returns to his dungeon. Now, actually, in this production, he doesn't descend. It's very interesting. The set is of a great sort of silver box in which there is the banquet. It's a beautiful room. And then that turns, and it's revealed that underneath the banqueting room are the prisons, these terrible prisons where Johanahan is imprisoned. And rather than him ascending into the light, which is the way it was originally written, Salome goes down to him with all of the psychological implications of that. She goes down to him, and then when he rejects her, she is the one who has to come back up to the banquet, which is what happens. So let's hear a little of that end of where he leaves her, returns to his dungeon, cursing Salome.
Verflucht!
listening to music from the opera Salome by Richard Strauss. And now let's move on with the story. Salome goes back to the banquet. Now the really bad stuff starts to occur.
It starts, yeah. Herod is in the midst of entertaining his friends, and he sees Salome, and he asks her to come and drink with him, and she refuses. He asks her to come, and he asks that fruit be brought. He said, "Bring me ripe fruit. Salome, come and eat fruit with me. I love to see in the fruit the mark of thy little teeth. Bite but a little of this fruit, and then I will eat what is left." And that already gives a sense of the sort of grotesque lust that he has for his stepdaughter. She says, "I am not hungry, I am not tired." He offers her the veil of the temple, her mother's throne, anything. And then she stops and pauses and thinks, "Yes, there is something I would like. I would like the head of John the Baptist." But before we get that, let's play a little of that interaction between Herod and Salome. And so what we just heard was the interaction between a lecherous, he's both her stepfather and her uncle. And basically she's got him wrapped around her little finger because he's like, "Dance for me. I'll do anything for you." And she says, "Okay. Bring me the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter." Exactly. In the original story, it suggested that it was Herodias, that when Herod said, "I'll give you anything you want," Salome goes to her mother and says, "What should I ask for?" And Herodias comes back and says, "The head of John the Baptist." But in the play and in this production, it's very interesting. Why would Salome ask for the head of a prophet? That's a pretty grotesque request for a man that a few minutes earlier she's been trying to seduce. In this interpretation, there are three reasons given for why Salome wants the head of John the Baptist. She wants, this is a woman taking a stand. She wants three things. She wants to revenge the insult that Yohanan has made her in rejecting her. She's annoyed about that. She's angry at the father she never knew. He was a captive for 12 years in this dungeon, in this prison, and apparently it suggested he was actually imprisoned in the very same dungeon where Yohanan is being held captive. So there's that overlay there, that her father abandoned her, that Yohanan rejected her, and she hates her. So she wants to get back at him. And these are the reasons that she chooses to do the dance. So now we come to the dance, which has a very, very gentle sort of sinuous Eastern style opening to it. And in this production, it's going to be very interesting the way it's done. Let me give you a little suggestion here from the director. He says, "The Dance of the Seven Veils is one of the places where all of the motivic elements come together. Here we see Salome's quest to discover the mystery of herself and her father. the same quest of self-discovery represented in psychoanalysis. Ultimately, it is not her body, but her naked mind that shocks us. That's what this director is trying to get at here. So the dance then is not a dance of seven veils physically, where she drops seven pieces of costumes. She goes into this great square box, and it's as if she's peeling off layer by layer the levels in her mind that have held back these memories. She has an image of her father prisoned in the dungeon and Herod coming in and strangling her father. Then she has an image of a young child that is herself as she was when she was a very young child, and Herod coming in and touching her in a very inappropriate way. Nothing happened there.
And we see all this on stage?
We see. This is the Dance of the Seven Veils as she goes back into her repressed memories. It's straight Freud. It actually is based on Freud's iceberg theory, which, if I may, I'll just read a little from Opera Unveiled. Opera suddenly takes me into these extraordinary areas of psychoanalysis and now the iceberg theory. Freud suggested that the mind is likened to an iceberg. Only the tip of the iceberg or the mind is visible. That's our conscious or awareness state. Just under the waterline is our preconscious or dream state. The vast bulk of the iceberg or mind is hidden from view. We're unaware of it. This is our unconscious. The unconscious contains instincts, passions, and fears. It is here that long-forgotten memories of personality-forming experiences are held. This is straight Freud. Freud thought bits of our unconscious could break off and float to the surface of our conscious awareness and appear as forms of neuroses. His theory stated that the mind is like an iceberg. It floats with 1/7 of its bulk above the water. Now, this production then explores these levels above and below the surface in the mind, the being, and the soul of the young Salome. So she goes in and explores all of this. So she does the dance, and then Herod orders that the executioner go down and behead Johanahan, which happens, and she goes down, and in this extraordinary final aria, which is terrifying to watch because she kisses the lips of the head of the dead man.
I know, it's so disgusting.
It's so horrendous. But she is having, as the director says, the axis has sort of turned for her. She is mad now. She is completely transported to another place. And in this production, is not killed by the soldiers' swords, but she's come to a sort of an awareness of why she is the way she is, what is at the root of all of her angst and her fears and the horror of what she has lived through. And so it is a moment of catharsis, and that is explained in the music, in the last final chord of this opera, where the entire audience, you don't have to get the whole psychoanalytical bit, but you understand that something has been resolved and discovered and understood. Typically it ends in her death, but not in this production.
I mean, you think of a catharsis usually as some kind of
healing.
Emotional release and something is learned, but here she's just completely unhinged. She's crazy. She's had a man killed and now she's kissing his lips because he wouldn't kiss her when he was alive.
It's an extreme piece. It comes from that symbolist decadence, a period of time in writing and literature, and it will be in that dress of the period. Herodias will be dressed in the very ornately in the costumes of the early 20th century, and Salome will be a lesser version of that. So there's a lot of challenge in this production that we are being presented with by Daniel Slater, but I think an interesting one. I think it's time to move on now from the straight biblical interpretation. And dysfunctional families are still with us, and this is a classic example, probably the worst.
So shall we hear the final aria?
Let's hear a little of her final aria, yes, to wrap this up.
Thank you.
And that was the final aria from Salome by Richard Strauss in the Santa Fe Opera production this summer. Now, talk a little bit about the singers who are going to be singing it, mm-hmm. who are singing it this summer at the Santa Fe Opera.
Yeah, this is a production not to be missed, I think. It'll be different. It'll be stretching for an audience. It's good for an audience to be stretched in an opera they think they know. This is a production that's been done many times here at the Santa Fe Opera. John Crosby did it many times. It's been had many different interpretations. This is new, and it'll be new in terms of who the Salome is. A young Bulgarian singer whose name is Alex Penda, really Alexandra Pendachansky. she sang Fidelio last year, which is amazing. So anyone who saw that, the Beethoven Fidelio, with this very tiny, slight woman singing the leading role of Fidelio, will be singing Salome. It's the first time that she has taken this on, and she and the director have been working this through in Paris, which seems appropriate since the whole thing seemed to have happened there. Her Johanahan is Ryan McKinney, who is singing here for the first time, and Robert Brubaker is Herod. So it'll be, I think this will be a fine production. The conductor is David Robertson, who is the conductor of the St. Louis Symphony, with an amazing reputation for interpreting the roles of Strauss. This is not easy, because, as I say, the orchestra plays such a major role in the whole piece.
Now, this piece was or must have been scandalous when it first came out.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it scandalized most people. The performance of the play by Wilde was banned after the first performance. The censor in London said, the Lord Chamberlain said, you can't have biblical people portrayed on stage, but in fact they were so shocked at the content it got banned. The first performance, however, in December of 1905 in Dresden was an unqualified success. The Germans got it. It ran for 38 curtain calls.
38,
at the opening,
I know, I love that.
At the opening night. In Vienna, however, a neighboring city, the opera was banned by Archbishop Piffle. I love that. Who said the whole opera was immoral. But then on the other hand, a few years later, Mahler, the great Gustav Mahler, spared no effort to have the opera done. And his failure led in part to his own resignation from the Vienna State Opera. That was big.
So he basically said, Mahler said, this is great art, we're going to do it.
And
he
the Vienna State Opera
Vienna
said
no,
no way.
No way.
Exactly, yeah.
And he's like, okay, I'm out of here.
Mahler said, this is entirely a work of genius. There is a Vulcan, Strauss, living and working there beneath a spoil heap, a subterranean fire, not just a firecracker. I suppose the same can be said of Strauss's own whole personality. Because it seemed on the face of it that Strauss was a fairly placid husband who was married to a very domineering wife who did as he was told. If you arrived at their house, she'd tell you to wipe your feet before you could come in. And he was composing at the same time as composing this extraordinary piece. He was composing the Domestic Symphony, which is about married bliss. He went on then to compose Electra. That was the next piece, which was equally shocking from the Greek tragedy, but another powerful, amazing piece of music. And then he did a complete about-face. He composed the neoclassic Der Rosenkavalier, because now he had the great librettist who worked with him for most of his great operas, Hugo von Hofmann style, and the style changed. He sort of backed off, if you like. So this opera has been called everything from extraordinarily wonderful to tawdry. That was a word that was used about this opera as late as 1990. So, you don't want to be too emotionally sensitive to some of these issues when they're presented. But it's life. You know, it is a dysfunctional family at its worst. We hear worse stories in the newspaper and on the news on the television each night. But when you're forced to
worse,
actually...
You think a lot worse?
Oh, I think somewhat worse. I mean, they're admittedly all put together here. Yeah. And the music makes you feel it in a way you don't feel it if you read about it. We read so much horror now in the papers of what's going on that we've got a sort of skin against it. This music won't let you escape. You almost hold your breath for an hour and a half until that last chord where musically it's resolved.
I have to say, I mean, I think it's absolutely brilliant to do a Freudian interpretation because mm-hmm. this is what you have. I mean, who was it? Somebody wrote an essay about how if tragic heroes and heroines had had access to psychotherapy, they might have, you know.
It might have been a different story.
It would have been a different play and everybody would have lived happily and in harmony and stuff.
Yeah, but by the same token, I think Freud himself would have had a field day with Salome. I mean, can
you
imagine?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's so perfect to take something of this level of sort of drama and craziness and look at it psychologically.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. He does take a lot of the religious undertones out of it, so it becomes a straight sort of Freudian piece. But it can handle that. It doesn't have to be John the Baptist. Already his name is different, Yochanan, which is as it is in the opera. So he is a religious zealot, a prophet, and Herod is superstitious about, you know, holding up this possibly holy man. He doesn't want to take the risk.
Well, very, very interesting piece and interpretation. Let's talk about some of the other things that are going on at the Santa Fe Opera. It's always important that we have to talk about things like what happens before the opera, like tailgating and the preview
buffet.
How do you
eat?
Well, it's important. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, go to the opera on a full stomach. I'm just saying.
It's a long night.
Yeah, it's a long night. I once left after act two out of three acts because I was so hungry.
Oh, that's terrible.
I wish
I'd known. I'd have found you something. There are many ways of going to the opera and eating, it turns out now. And in fact, that's part of the experience. I think the usual thing we do is we race from wherever we are, park our car and get frustrated because we're late parking, go to the show and sit down. It takes you the first 15 minutes to settle in. That's a shame. At the Santa Fe Opera, you need to be there hours ahead to absorb the sunset, sometimes to even experience those amazing storms that go on. So there's lots of ways of eating ahead of curtain. The curtain in July is 8:30. That's an improvement on 9, most people think. And the curtain in August starts at 8 o'clock. So that's manageable, but you need to eat. So how do you eat at the opera? Well, the traditional way is tailgating. You take your car, your truck, whatever it is, you open the back up, you bring out the gorgeous white linen and cut glass and have a gourmet meal or a hamburger you picked up on the way from McDonald's, whatever you want to do. That's actually helped a little now by the opera itself. As part of this expansion, they have a dining terrace, which is right by the box office. You can buy sort of a box meal, take it to your car, eat it there. That's one way of doing it. That's a fun way of going. You can come to the preview buffet, which is where I hang out. This is a lovely dining area on the opera grounds. You just go over the hill down the other side, surrounded by gardens and rehearsal halls. And nearly 200 people come each night to have dinner there, dinner with wine. And the dinners are sort of matched to the opera of the day in terms of food. So I wonder what they're going to serve for Salome and Freud.
Don't
even think about it. You're right. And then there's wines that are matched with that, and you have all of that. And it's a lovely way of being prepared and fed before you go to the opera.
Now, when you say the preview buffet is where you hang out, you actually give talks.
I do, yes. I come up with dessert. You get there a couple of hours before the curtain. You have dinner, and just as dessert is served, I give a 20-25-minute talk about the opera of the day so people are prepared as to what they're going to see. And then you can walk up the hill. Your car is parked where you want it to be, and you can enjoy the performance. That's a really nice way of going to the opera. But if you want to come to the preview buffets, you need to call the box office the minute you turn off the show because they are limited seating, and there is a charge, of course, and the box office will reserve your place for the preview buffet.
Now, Oliver Présent also gives talks?
Yes, there are two ways. If you don't want to come to the preview buffet and hear the talk there, you can go to Stearin Hall. This is, if you are a ticket holder, these are free talks. So 2 hours before the performance or 1 hour before, Oliver Présent, my colleague who does a wonderful job, will do the same sort of thing. He will give background to the opera and tell you all about it. And you can, if you have your ticket to the opera, you can go free to Stearin Hall, which is right by the box office.
And then you go an hour or 2 hours in advance. Oliver is the director of the Santa Fe Community Orchestra. He's amazing. And then you go back to your car and have your tailgate.
Yes, exactly. And if you don't have a car, you can come up on a shuttle, the other way of coming to the opera. The opera now has organized shuttle buses, both from Albuquerque and the main hotels in Santa Fe, that arrive either in time for the curtain at the start of the opera or early if you want to come to one of these meals or the lectures. So So you need to call the box office to reserve a space for that. That's a nice way to come, too, especially if you live in Albuquerque and if people don't want to face... I mean, I've been so altered after some of these operas. The mere idea of driving to Albuquerque safely afterwards... In fact, I nearly got pulled up by a policeman once. I was driving too fast as I approached El Dorado. He says, what do you think you're doing at one in the morning? So I said, officer, I was just being to this incredible opera and the music was so great and I'm still in the music. And he said, oh, I don't want to ruin your night drive on. That really happened. I don't advise it now that I've advertised it, I suppose. But
do you remember what the opera was?
No, I have no idea. No, it was one of those stunning nights, though. You come out of the Santa Fe Opera with the stars and the moon, and you know you're in an altered state, especially if you've just been to Salome, because you're not quite clear what sort of an altered state you're in, and it stays with you. So take the shuttle, then it'll take you home, and you can maintain the mood, as it were. On the way up, the opera's asked me to do little recordings about the operas, so I give a brief introduction that you can hear on the bus as you drive up, but they leave you alone on the way home.
For those who are listening who have never been to the Santa Fe Opera, one of the things that characterizes this theater, I don't know if it's unique in the world in terms of being an opera locale of this character that's open, but the wind blows through.
Yes, it does.
It doesn't rain on you,
but
it's open to the weather, and basically the sun is setting as you're sitting down. And occasionally there are thunderstorms that on a really lucky night, the thunderstorm coincides with the most dramatic parts of the opera.
Two of the highlights for me and with this opera company over a number of years have been the end of the first act of Don Giovanni, where there is a storm and there's symphony and there's thunder and lightning. And as if Mozart was up there on cue directing the thunder and lightning, it had the entire audience on the edge of their seats. It was extraordinary because of the timing, even through the singers. You know, every time there's supposed to be a crash, it happened in the heavens. The other was a Salome moment, because so much of the beginning of this opera compares her to the moon, the silveriness, the etherealness, the veiling and unveiling of the moon for Salome, that at the dress rehearsal, the moon was directly overhead at the execution of Johanna, and that was amazing. And the director was really upset because the moon would not stay in place for the other performances. So the question now is what to go to. Actually, we should talk maybe a little bit about family nights, if we can. Anyone can buy tickets, of course, by calling 986-50-900. But this opera has been wonderful in reaching out to young people. These are our audience members of the future. They do fabulous educational programs in the schools. But it's summertime and school is out. So a family night provides a wonderful opportunity for families to buy tickets that are normally full-price tickets for a fraction of the cost. The only provider is that you have to bring one child per order. So round up some kids, introduce them to opera, and you can take them. There are three performances for family nights for Daughter of the Regiment, two for La Finta Giardiniera, two for Salome. You could bring older... I wouldn't bring a young child under 10 to Salome.
I was going to say.
But teenagers, yes, why not? And there's one performance of Cold Mountain that the opera has made available, these seats, at these incredibly discounted prices for you to bring family members, friends, kids. Actually, that's how I introduced my kids to opera, through one of the school programs at the Utah Opera. They came regularly, and they never forgot it. I took them to a performance, a dress rehearsal of The Merry Widow with Roberta Peters singing. But that night, Roberta wasn't feeling well. She didn't want to sing at the dress, so the understudy stood in for her to sing. But the understudy got a bit miffed because she was singing, but Roberta's still singing in the wings, and the conductor is singing from the pit. All three of them are singing the role of The Merry Widow. My kids thought that was the funniest thing, and they never forgot it. And they can sing you that aria to this day.
Oh, my goodness. That's so funny. And it's so interesting interesting to see the reaction of kids, because kids are a great barometer of whether something is boring or not.
Yeah, when we bring kids to rehearsals, as we do at the opera here, the artists are always fascinated because the laughs may come in different places, and they need to think about that. Is this right, appropriate, or did the kids get it and the adults not? All sorts of things happen. You get a different sense of how you're coming across, but opera absolutely holds these kids. There's an apprentice tour that goes out in the spring that the education department puts on that goes to schools in all of the states around us here. That's a roaring success. You've only got to look at the faces of those kids from age 5 on up, totally enthralled. They choose pieces that are age appropriate for them, but nevertheless, they're getting it. And kids love music, and they love to move and dance, and you know they get into it. It's great. They don't have the hang-ups that so many adults do. They can deal with masks and pretense and in ways that we're asking real questions. They don't ask the questions. They just go for it. So we need to expose our kids to music, opera, dance, all of the arts. It's so important.
Desiree Mays, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet of the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number here in New Mexico is 505-986-5900.